web services.
Welcome to the Cloudonaut podcast. We are your hosts, Andreas and
Michael Wittig. We have been building on AWS since 2009. Follow along as we develop products like BucketEV, Marbot or HyperEnv and learn from practice. This is episode number 81 and we are recording this on September the 28th in 2023. In case you are watching this live on YouTube, feel free to ask your questions. Unfortunately, the LinkedIn live stream is not working today, so we will make sure that this works next time. All right, Andreas, so what's the first topic? So what did you learn in the last couple of days?
Yeah, so Michael, when we recorded the last episode, I already teased a little bit that I'm working on migrating lots of our Lambda functions from the JavaScript SDK version 2 to version 3. And I'm almost through this migration. So maybe to give some background. So the problem is that Node.js 16 has reached end of life at the beginning of September. So you definitely need to upgrade to Node.js 18. But when you do so for Lambda functions, the problem is that the built-in AWS SDK that ships with the Node.js 18 environment is the version 3 SDK, the new SDK that AWS has announced some time ago. And I think AWS also has announced that they are sunsetting version 2, but they are postponing this date from time to time. So let's see how this goes. But yeah, but if you want to, so the thing is, if you want to use Lambda functions with Node.js 18 and you're not packaging the SDK on your own into the zip file that you deploy, so you're using the one that ships with Lambda, then you have to migrate to the JavaScript SDK version 3. So that's definitely the thing. And the problem is that this is not 100% backwards compatible. So you have to rewrite all the code that is calling any of the SDK functionalities. So I've written a blog post about my learnings. So maybe first of all, so there is finally a few weeks, month ago, AWS released a kind of working documentation for version 3. So there's an API reference that I'm using. And there are upgrading notes where AWS describes what they think is important when upgrading from 2 to 3. So I put links to all of that to the video description and the show notes. So what are the things that you need to know about migrating from version 2 to version 3? So the first thing is that importing the client for the different AWS services works differently. So that is important to know. There are two options. You can either import ES modules, or you can use the kind of old style way of doing it with common JS modules. So both options are available. So if you want to, you can choose between those two options. But if you are using CloudFormation to write Lambda functions with inline code, as far as I can tell, the only option is the common JS modules, because to use the ES modules, you have to either use a special file suffix or you have to define this in the package JSON. And both are options that are not available when inlining the file in CloudFormation, to my knowledge at least. So if you do, we do a lot of CloudFormation functions, Lambda functions inline in CloudFormation, because it's so easy to the easiest way for customers to deploy them, because you don't have to do any command line stuff or upload any thing to your account. And if you do that, I think the only way is the common JS modules, which is the one with require and so on. This is the common JS module way of doing things. And then a big change is that formerly with version 2, we had things like, for example, ECS dot list container instances, just a method name, and then you hand it over to parameters. With version 3, you do commands instead. So each client has a send method, and you hand over a command that is then basically the thing that you want to execute. So that means you have to rewrite all the code, have to replace the method names, have to create these command objects. So yeah, I don't know. It's boring work because you obviously just the parameters stay the same, luckily, but you have to go through all your code and replace those things and double check the documentation for the command names and so on. So that's a little a bummer. Then the next thing I run into is, if you remember, Michael, with version 2, if you want to use the async away style, you had to add dot promise to every method call over the AWS SDK to get the promise back that you then can wait for. The default was callback style. With version 3, it's the other way around. So the default is basically giving back a promise. And you can, but you can still use it in a callback style by handing over a second parameter to the send method, which is then the callback function. So not only the command, and then hand over the callback function, then this works as well. So I've written a lot of all Lambda functions, Michael, and I try to keep the style. So if we used async await, I keep that. If we used callbacks, I kept that, and I just rewrote the code around that. So otherwise, it's a lot of work and a lot can go wrong. Definitely. That's an issue. Another thing I ran into, and this was not clear to me from the documentation, and it is also hard to test, which is the error handling. So if a function, so if you call an API, AWS API, and the command fails, the error that comes back is now has a different structure. The error object basically has a different structure. So double check that. If you do, for example, I had something like S3 get object, and you then get back a no such key error. So make sure that these things are in the new format and follow the new basically arrow objects that the version 3 SDK uses. And then I run into two things with S3. So the version 2 SDK had a special method for uploading data, because the thing is, when you upload data to S3, if it's larger than a few megabytes, you should do it, you should split the upload in multiple chunks and upload them in parallel for performance reasons. And the version 2 SDK had the upload function, which was a higher level function. Basically, there's no API representation of this. This was just wrapping around put object is probably the API call behind that. And there is something similar with version 3, but it's not in the it's not included in the S3 client. It is a different library called libstorage that is also part of the SDK version 3. So check that out if you need that. And then the last challenge I had was, I needed to stream the data. So I download data from S3 and I upload it after transforming the data in a Lambda function. And because keeping everything in memory is not an option, writing it to disk is not an option, I try to stream the data through the Lambda function, which means I keep only parts of it in memory. And so the interface for that is also a little different. So last time, Michael, in the last podcast, we talked about that there is a streaming option available or not. There is. So in version 2, you had a function for that, create read stream. In version 3, when you do a get object command, what you get back is can be or is by default a stream. So you can use that representation of a stream right away. And you can also, when you do the put object command, you can hand over a stream as well. So that works, is built into that. But be careful, because if you do just put object with the version 3 API and hand over a stream, you have the issue that you need to know, how is it called, the body size or the object size. You need to specify that up front. If you do not know that, it's easier to do to use the upload function in F3, so the higher level construct, which is doing multi-port uploads, because by using that one, you don't have to specify the total object size up front. So that is what I'm using in my example, and all the code snippets are in the blog post. So if you try to figure out how that works, feel free to check that out. Yeah. So overall, Michael, so I'm not too happy with that change. So AWS is basically forcing us to upgrade to version 3 because we have no other option. And then they come with an SDK that is not backwards compatible with version 2, and we have to rewrite all our code. I'm not too happy about all of that. I think probably you could do better when making such a change, but yeah, that's how it is. So here we are. I've been going through all of that, spent useless hours on rewriting our code, but hey, yeah, that's it. And if you do the same, check out the blog post and maybe avoid some of the traps that are out there.
Yeah, Andreas, I remember one other thing that was not kind of working the same way in version 3 than version 2 that we were running into, and I just remember that while you were talking. So in one of our functions, we call the S3 get bucket location API, which basically tells us in which region the bucket lives. And for, I think, historical reasons, if the bucket lives in US East 1, you will not get back a region code like US East 1. You just get back, and in version 2 SDK, the value was null. And in version 3, the value is undefined. So that's a slight difference, because I like in JavaScript, I really like to check for null or undefined. So I want to be very specific using the equals comparison operator. So in that case, that just was not working anymore. So we didn't detect that this was the region US East 1 anymore. And I mean, those kind of things are kind of impossible to find without really running the code against the real API and things like that. Yeah, so that's a little bit problematic, as you already mentioned. Okay. One thing, Andreas, I think maybe I'm completely wrong, but didn't you discover a way in the version 3 SDK to also use the method style invocation somehow instead of the send?
It's good question, Michael. Yes, I remember something, but I didn't use it now. So I think there is a way to use the, kind of a method style, but I think it's, you have to rewrite your code a little bit with that as well. And the problem is AWS does not, so it's at a legacy option, and you should not use it, because they say they will deprecate that as well in the future. So that's why I just rewrote all the code and using the command.
It makes sense to use the new kind of way, and but yeah, I was just remembering that. Okay.
There's something, yeah.
All right. So next topic, Andreas. I did some work using a feature of CloudWatch dashboards that I not used before, and it's called a custom widget. So to start, what's a CloudWatch dashboard? Just to make sure that everyone is on the same page. A CloudWatch dashboard is basically, it's a way to define widgets and position them, and you can display CloudWatch metrics, you can display CloudWatch logs, and metrics can be displayed in different ways. So you can have a simple chart, you can have pie charts, I think, you can have stacked charts, all kinds of different ways to display data. It is, of course, not as, it's not a Grafana dashboard or something. It's, I mean, it's an AWS dashboard, so it lacks all the capabilities that you usually want to see, but there is some basic stuff available. And one addition that was released, I think it's not a very new feature, right? It was released quite some time ago. It's called a custom widget. So custom widget is basically a way to invoke a Lambda function from within the dashboard when it loads. And the Lambda function returns data, and this is displayed by the dashboard. All right. So two use cases that we implemented, or that I implemented, and they were both for our BucketDB product. This is the antivirus for Amazon S3 solution that we offer. The first widget displays if you're using the up-to-date version of our product. So we compare the version that you run against, and like we have a JSON endpoint on our website, basically that returns the current version. We compare the versions. If the one that you're running is not the one that's latest, we tell you that you should update, and we add a button into the widget. And when you click that button, the update process basically starts. So that's also a cool feature of a widget. You can also have interactivity in them. So you cannot only display data, you can also react to clicks on links and buttons. The second use case is a widget that displays a table of all your S3 buckets. And we enrich this table with information if you have real-time and scheduled scanning enabled for that bucket. And if it's not enabled, we basically add a button. And if you push that button, you either enable it directly, or if your configuration is a little bit more complicated, then we redirect you to our documentation. So that's the two use cases. So it's a feature that many of our customers requested, because for people that don't manage their infrastructure using infrastructure as code, it is definitely simpler to just click the buckets that you want to be scanning. All right. So now we dive a little bit into the internals, Andreas. So I said you can return data. So what kind of data can you return? So there are three different kind of types of returns. You can either return a string containing HTML, you can return JSON, or you can return Markdown. And Markdown is kind of, it's a JSON with one attribute called Markdown, and this is then a string with the Markdown. And then it's displayed in the dashboard. Most HTML tags are supported. One that you might have in mind that is not supported is the iframe tag, so you cannot kind of include external stuff in there. And you have CSS support, and you have also SVG support. So you could, like with SVG, you can create, for example, very interesting graphs and stuff like that. So that's supported and it's possible. By default, some HTML elements like tables, input and select elements, as well as header elements and a couple of others are styled using the CloudWatch dashboard default style. So if you, for example, define an HTML table, it will look nice by default. So that's very cool. And as I said, you could add your own CSS if you wish, but it's not needed. So for all the widgets that I created, Andreas, I went just with the default styling, and this looks good as far, at least for my visual, how to call this? Yeah, at least for my eye, it looks good. So one thing that is not supported, and this is might not a surprise, is JavaScript. And this is for security reasons. So basically, AWS does not allow you to inject anything in the widget that could then potentially alter the console, right? So that's not supported. But as I already said, there is an interactivity capability to those custom widgets. And this is basically an HTML element. And this is like, the name is a little bit strange, but it's called CVDB-action. And with this element, if you put that next to an, for example, link or a button, you can define what happens when the button is clicked. And the two, I would say, kind of popular option is you can call a Lambda function. And this Lambda function can then either do something and you keep the widget as it is, or you can return new data for the widget. So for example, a new HTML string, and then the widget is updated using the response of the Lambda function. You can also open a pop-up, and you can then add there either static or also dynamic information that comes from a Lambda function. And there's also confirmation functionality. If you click on the button, there comes a confirmation prompt before the Lambda function is actually invoked. And so that's really neat. And that's what I already used in our two use cases, as I said, too. You can push the update button. You can also push the enable real-time or enable scheduled scanning for a bucket. So that was really cool. I liked it. And very easy to use. There are, I think, 10 or so examples from AWS. So I looked at an example at the beginning just to get an idea how everything needs to be done. They are CloudFormation templates, so you can just see everything that needs to be deployed. And one thing that I missed, Andreas, and it's kind of, I still don't really know how it works, is the Lambda function and the CloudWatch dashboard are, from a permission perspective, not connected in any ways. So, for example, if you connect the Lambda function with an S3 bucket or something, then you add a Lambda permission, like allow this S3 service to evoke your Lambda function. With a CloudWatch dashboard, that's not needed. So there is no IAM role and also no Lambda function permissions that are needed to make it work. The only thing that they have is, when you look at the dashboard the very first time, they ask you if you really want to invoke this Lambda function. And then you can, I think you can either, trust this forever or trust this once or something like that, and then they invoke the function. I'm not sure who the invoker is actually. I never looked that up in CloudTrail, if it's me, like my identity that browses the console, or if it's the some magic dashboard way to access the Lambda function. But that was very confusing for me, so I expected that I need to do something to allow the dashboard to call the function. Yeah, so that's the only thing that was a little bit confusing, but the rest is straightforward and it works. And besides me shipping a tiny bug that many of our customers quickly discovered when they opened the dashboard after the update, which is fixed since yesterday. So yesterday was the next release was yesterday. So our customers are very happy with the feature. So a lot of them already tried it out, and unfortunately we received lots of support emails, right, because it was not working. But they are all happy now. I just reached out to them in the morning and told them that there's now an official update available and they can now update and fix the problem. So that was my topic, Andreas. So what else do you have on your list?
I have one question. So CloudWatch dashboard, there's the option that you just log into the AWS account and then go to CloudWatch and check the dashboard. And there's also the option to share a dashboard with others that do not have any IAM credentials. I think it's with a kind of public URL with a hidden secret in it. Do you know if that custom widgets work with those shared dashboards as well? Did you check that?
I haven't tried it. I haven't read anything in the documentation about it's not working. There are also cross-account dashboards and stuff, and as far as I understand the docs, it works. But if that really works, then there must be... I mean, I really don't get how they invoke my Lambda function.
That was why I was thinking about that. So that's something to investigate a little bit further, Michael. I mean, that's interesting.
I once deployed such a public dashboard, Andreas, and I don't know if it's still the same today, but they basically create Cognito user pool and all kinds of resources in your account, and there's no way to delete them afterwards. So it was really... I was just a little bit shocked what's going on when you create this public dashboard. Yeah.
Okay, the last time I tried this, it was just generating a URL with a secret in it, and you could just share that URL, and everyone with the URL got access to the dashboard. But okay, I don't know if there are other options.
Definitely improvement, yeah.
Okay, so let's see. Okay, that interesting thing. Okay, let's check that. Okay, so the last thing is I want to talk about is talk about Terraform. So I think we had a similar discussion in this podcast, but now I have written a blog post about it to summarize my learnings, and I wanted to share those summarized learnings here. So the thing is, with Terraform, when you do, for example, use providers like obviously the AWS provider when you work with AWS, then you do define the version of the, for example, AWS provider that you want to use in your Terraform configuration. And I did so. So I had a Terraform configuration where I was defining I want to use the AWS provider version 3 dot something. And I used a Terraform module, the VPC module, a very common one to spin up a VPC very easily. And then after a few years, I tried to run that code again. And before doing so, I was just making sure to update everything to the latest version. So I was updating the required AWS provider to major version 5, because that's now I think it's still the current AWS provider version. And then I run into an issue. I got an an arrow from Terraform saying the argument named enable classic link is not expected here. And I could not understand where this is coming from. And it took me a while to understand that this was coming from the module that I was using, the Terraform module. And then I learned that the Terraform module that I was using was defining a required Terraform provider as well. But it just said, I want to have a Terraform provider with version greater than 3 dot something. And the problem is 5 dot something is obviously greater than 3 dot something. So if you specify a version, that's true. So Terraform says, oh, that's fine. I can use version 5 of the Terraform provider. No issue here. But the problem is between the major versions of the Terraform provider, you have breaking changes. So they do, I don't know, deprecate in this example, the thing I mentioned, the attribute with classic link was just deprecated because it no longer exists because AWS sunsetted that feature completely now. It's possible between major versions of a Terraform provider that you have breaking changes that you need to consider in your Terraform code. But the specification of the Terraform provider just said something greater than 3 dot something, major version 3. And so Terraform did not know about that issue, actually. And so the question is, how do you solve that problem? And when you look into the Terraform documentation, what you can find there is the recommendation is, if you define the version of a Terraform provider, and I think it's true for any other version that you define in Terraform, you can not only say, I want a specific version greater than or greater equal something, but you can also say, I want to lock the major version of something. And this is, I think, the recommended way to specify the AWS provider in your Terraform code. Say, so I want Terraform provider version 3, 4, 5, what have you, if you start now, probably 5. And then this ensures that Terraform can pick basically the latest version of the Terraform provider with major version 5. So you get the latest updates automatically, those without breaking changes. But when there is the next major version coming out, version 6, for example, then you do not automatically use that one, which then breaks all or potentially breaks parts of your Terraform code. And so I think that is important. So if you want to future-proof, define the Terraform provider, then make sure that you specify the basically only lock the major version. And in the blog post, you can find the code to do so. So I learned that the hard way. And I think this is especially important if you publish Terraform modules that a lot of others are using, where you're not controlling who is using that.
All right, Andreas, that sounds good. Good approach. It kind of applies to any dependency kind of thing that you add to your code as well. So make sure that the version constraints don't cause issues in the future. Yeah. All right. So that's it, right?
Perfect. Okay, Michael. Yeah, that's it. We'll be back soon. Subscribe to our newsletter, podcast, or YouTube channel to ensure you're not missing any of the upcoming shows or the content that we publish. So you'll find all links in the show notes or the video description.
Yeah, thanks for joining. Bye.
Bye.